actually three wars on Iraq. There was the invasion in 91, there was the invasion in 2003, and there were the sanctions in between, which has probably killed more people than the two invasions did, although you don't want to make those gruesome comparisons. But the sanctions certainly had a lot of impact on birth defects, too, in many as well. They were killing, certainly, five people that hadn't even been born yet, and so it's not uncommon to think that there are logical probably to think that they were resulting in malnutrition and contaminated water, which was leading to birth defects and affecting the statistics as well, weren't they?
Well, you know what? The data that Dr. Alsobok showed you for 1993, 1994, that was during the sanctions.
Right,
so the sanctions were actually not as devastating to the public health as these bombings and these pollutants. It doesn't seem to me.
Well, it didn't go through all the way from 1995 to 2003. I mean, UNICEF was estimating that an additional 5,000 Iraqi children per month were dying as a result of these sanctions. I mean, it must have carried over to...
Yeah. But we didn't see that in the... But in terms of birth defects and health of mothers and children, probably less. Yeah.
Air pollution and water pollution never did congenital birth defect. This is for your information. What only did birth defect, there must be something interfere with the DNA on the start. Something with the during the period of embryogenesis. That was the period of the formation of an embryo, which occurred between 8 to 12 weeks of gestation. As early as that period, the defect occurred. And do you think a simple pollution of water will lead to birth defect? If this is yes, the answer is yes, then 50% of people, they would have congenital amenorrhea. Because the water is polluted in a lot of countries. Not this one, definitely, because our waters haven't changed the last 20 years. We have the same environment and the same water, and we don't have any change at that. But these are a factor which could help or could aggravate the condition, but not considered as a cause. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yes. Kind of just to pick up on what you just mentioned, what is the sense of the roots of exposure that if this is connected to what you displayed in your overheads, is really the cause? Is it all airborne? Is it food, water? What's your sense of that?
Well, from what I know from the area, in terms of the geography and also like the temperatures, Basra and all over Iraq, the temperatures are quite high for a very long period of time. So many of these things could continually be, airborne. And there is also very long periods of time when you have sandstorms. So it circulates everything. It continues to inject stuff into the air and circulate it all over. These are the two things that stand out in my mind. There was a woman at Princeton when we gave the same talk, and she said that, I think she must have been a military person, she said that she was on a U.S. military base in Iraq for 4 years, and she said every time there would be a sandstorm, all the magnetic doors that open, they would go crazy and they would be slapping open shut, and it would have been, they all wondered why that could be, and I can't imagine. Would there have been like so much metals in these dust storms that they would interfere with it? Is that possible? The whole locale is quite turbulent in terms of temperatures and
One more thing you should consider, and you should keep it in your mind. Irradiation and other biological weapons, it never leaves the body. It means what we call the building dose.
Cumulative, yeah.
So let's suppose you have an X-ray in your life. If you have done this X-ray, you will receive 0.5 rad, which is a unit used for measuring radiation. If you have another X-ray for any other reason, then you will have 1 rad. So body will not excrete this radiation. You will build them. That's why we always, when we want to take an X-ray for a patient, or we did an IVP or whatever procedures had the radiation, we told them that you are going to receive such a, this will not left your body. And you see now Japanese, a long period after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they have this birth effect, till now. Even if they have one generation skipped, they will have the next generation. So it is our question that someone should help to remove this effect from the population, which might last longer than what we have now talking about.
I'm a midwife here in Cambridge, and so I'm interested in the experience of the providers and the mothers. During what kind of prenatal screening do your average patients receive? Do they have, like, because you mentioned a lot of the women being affected by this are coming from rural areas, so I imagine they don't have a lot of access to prenatal ultrasounds. So how often do you know about the...
You see, the problem now in my country, I had an ultrasound in my clinic, and I can't tell the patient she had whether or she had no congenital anomaly. But the problem is that they will never let her to terminate her pregnancy,
right,
neither legally nor by religiously. So she should carry a congenital anomaly baby, and she should complete her pregnancy, and no one should ask or terminate her pregnancy. In developed countries, this problem is already dissolved, because those who are exposed to have, like, let's say a woman who's got married while she is 41 or 42 years, she is married, she is liable to have Mongolism, what we call trisomy, or certain congenital. So they would do what we call a CVS. CVS means chorionic villi sampling. They do sampling to the chorionic villi at 9 weeks of gestation, and they do genetic study to these chromosomes, number and structure. If they have any chromosomal abnormality, they will go ahead and terminate the pregnancy before the pregnancy reaches to the second trimester. But in my country, the problem is that legally not accepted to terminate. So women should carry a congenital anomaly baby until she became 9 months of gestation, and then she could deliver, and definitely she will have the fetus. This is the problem, yeah.
Couple of questions. One is, how does the rate of incidence of this birth defect compare with what happened in, like, Laos and Vietnam and so forth, mm-hmm. where they just carpet bomb the country? And that's one question. Other is, to you, is this, if I heard it correct, you said that the DU is not responsible in terms of...
We don't know, but we can...
Now, how do you isolate from your... How do you isolate the effect of DU? From the rest of the stuff that's going on, in birth defects or whatever.
Well, I think if we could measure it, we could draw some kind of a conclusion. Say these types of birth defects are more often if you have to use. But we don't see high levels of uranium in any of our samples. So, which
but yet we're seeing leukemia.
Right.
So where did that come from?
This is an important question. I would answer it. The problem is that now we have to be on a solid base. In the solid base, you see the proof that you have a find a depleted uranium level which is high. Actually, I've started this research 23 years ago, in 1991, when was the first attack of Iraq by the U.S. Army. And we took tomato, the tomato and potatoes, and we burned it to measure the depleted uranium. Saddam was there still. And we advanced in our study. Someone had destroyed the study completely. And they stopped us. No more studies should be done on the subject. We collect a left tomato and we bring it to Baghdad to study the depleted uranium and to prove it. But the problem is that once you publish it in an area, and they will say this is a fabricated research.
Did you find it?
We found it. We found it. But the problem is that even if you publish it, they will claim that this research, because definitely they want to claim that U.S. had the drone and radiation and biological weapons and the radiation to Iraq. But this research is taken in consideration because it was published in Michigan. And the one who did the investigation, not me, not in Iraq, is done in Mount Sinai Hospital. Mount Sinai Hospital. So they proved the diagnosis and the condition of, that there is a raised of mercury and lead, which is the main component of weapons. Mm-hmm. The lead and the mercury, these are the main elements seen in weapons. Where do we find them? This is the message you want to people know.
So basically, that if the study is done in Europe, then it's discredited because of, they say, the the lab is incompetent or it's not?
Yeah, I couldn't do it. Even if I try my best to do it now when I came back to my country, but with the help of the laboratory here, so that no one would say this is a fabricated assay. Mm-hmm. I will choose the laboratory of US, mm-hmm. not my country. So that no one will say this is a fabricated or done in a country which is undependable or the lab are not efficient to say that definitely there is an increment in the level of depleted uranium. And I'm sure I will find something positive. At that time, I will present the same finding and possibly in the next or 1 or 2 years.
You know, another thing is with the people, we are pretty restricted to who is willing to participate in our study. So in terms of isolating effects on uranium, you know, we have whoever is willing to participate, and that makes it difficult to answer a lot of things, you know. So we have very little options, really.
I have a comment and a question.
Yes.
My comment is, in the 1970s in the United States, the issue of lead in gasoline mm-hmm. and effects on children. So you fast forward, so the lead was delivered outside the automobile onto the roadside, and it was picked up by plants, etc., in the air. And in every way, shape, or form, lead was available mm-hmm. because there's a lot of cars, a lot of driving. So lead was taken out in the 70s, late 70s. So by 5 years beyond that, in most of the studies that I've read, is the lead levels dramatically decreased. And that every child born in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts is tested for lead, parts per million, parts per billion. And they're given therapies if that is high. Say they live in an apartment and there's still lead thing from the 1960s, etc. So this is well known that lead competes with calcium in the brain, for instance. And there's so many calcium channels that are available throughout our body that if you have lead there instead of calcium, you know, you have all these problems that come beyond and they come through the individual and then they pass along to the next individuals, etc. This particular person delivers more. So that's my comment. My question is, magnesium is a necessary element mm-hmm. for human survival.
Yes. And it's actually protective of a lot of birth defects.
Yes, exactly. So I'm sorry I came in late, but I don't know what the levels are were they astronomical that you saw in these children, or were they just above mm-hmm. what's acceptable?
Well, looking at what magnesium levels were recorded in hair samples of other children, which very rarely do they report magnesium in hair. The only reason I looked at it is because I wanted to see, can I see anything that relates these children to soldiers? Because magnesium was high in their lungs and titanium was high in their lungs. I wanted to see. And comparing, so very few studies actually look at magnesium in children's hair. What I was able to find is significantly lower than this in other parts of the world. I think one study is in China, another study, I forget where it's from, but it's quite significantly lower than what we see in Iraq. But at the same time, in Iraq, we see that children who have birth defects in Khawija have lower magnesium than children who appear normal. They have a higher magnesium. So somehow magnesium has actually prevented neurodevelopmental disorder in some of the children. If they had high magnesium, they had less neurodevelopmental disorder. So it has protected. If it was high, it protected them. So it's a dual function, dual kind of situation with magnesium. It can be protective of children, protective against birth defects and against neurodevelopmental disorder. But overall, it's higher, much higher in children in Hawija compared to what has been published in other places, which isn't many, just a few.
I just want to go back to the comment you made about Basra. I distinctly remember the road to Basra and the bombing there, and the fact that there are uprisings. But I never connect. Are you saying the bombing on that road was connected with the uprising? I thought that was just fleeing soldiers.
Well,
I was a little bit confused.
Well, I think what happened in Iraq in 1991 when there was
an uprising? Yeah, the major attack was 1991.
Right.
But 2003 is most serious. It takes only 2 months, but was so serious and a lot of destruction happened.
I think you're thinking in terms of like the indigenous rebellion against Saddam. Are you thinking that?
Well, I know the two events happened, but
right.
Was there overlap between them?
I think so. I think it was around the same time, and then Saddam really suppressed the rebellion with the help of Bush administration. So people of Iraq have repeatedly tried to get rid of Saddam. And at those times when they were most able to do it, Bush helped to keep him. He kept him. And then later on, they used him and they crushed the civil society in Iraq and really, really harmed the country big time. So, yeah, I mean, people of Iraq have tried to get rid of the oppressors that U.S. installed in the first place anyway. And then when they tried repeatedly, this massive military industrial thing that you have here is really deadly to life everywhere. And I'm sorry to say that MIT is very active in, you know.
We're going to talk about that.
We're not MIT. Yeah.
I'm curious about Johns Hopkins.
Oh, yes.
That is very odd that they have so much.
Not very odd. They are the top recipient of U.S. military, U.S. Department of Defense. And this is only Department of Defense. It's not the Department of Energy, Department of all these other things. I read somewhere that 60% of research in all universities in the United States are related to defense, which is a really scary figure if you think about it. So, yeah, Johns Hopkins is the top recipient of U.S. Department of Defense funding. Somebody I read that said this is not sustainable. You cannot spend this much money on defense all the time in this way. But it's really, you know, it tells you that it's like the amount of violence unleashed on Iraq and the potential for it to be unleashed on so many other countries, including Iran. You know, no Iranian sleeps soundly at night because they are always waiting for U.S. drones to arrive. And it's quite horrible, really.
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to pick up on one of the last things you said about the overall devastation caused by the militarism. And I'm just wondering, what's the level of discourse in like diplomatic circles or any kind of policy circles about putting some, you know, quantification or control or remediation after the war is over? What about the accountability to go and clean up all the problems that are caused? Is anybody talking about this?
I don't think anybody is talking about it. I'm the only one who talks about cleaning up U.S. military bases in Iraq. Nobody is talking about it. I think to this day they have left those, Da Nang and all those airports that are polluted in Vietnam, they have left them and nobody is even cleaning them up. Only recently, right, they have allocated, I don't know, $40 million, which is peanuts. You cannot really clean much with that.
That's specifically for Agent Orange.
Right, only for that, yes. So it's I don't know what to tell you. I think there should be huge outrage at what they are doing, but not a peep out of this public, no.
I'd say there's one good news, and that is the Pentagon just announced that the threat to climate is a national security threat.
Okay.
This is going to be the next budget. The Pentagon is going to set up money to start working against or taking steps to mitigate. So I think the base cleanup, the pollution from that, we should be conscious of that and utilize that opening to look at this problem. So I mean, the pollution of the bases is not just a non-U.S. phenomenon. We have lots of bases here.
Absolutely.
That are completely polluted.
Totally true.
So, yeah.
Yes.
And so there's movement here. In cleaning up both the nuclear weapons complex as well as the conventional weapons business. So there is movement here, but there's pressure here much more than in the constituents in Congress than abroad in Vietnam or in Iraq.
But you know, I mean, I'm about these things and I didn't know that. I did not know that there is, you know, there's resistance here trying to clean up places.
Yes, base cleanup is a big thing. It happens during the base closure and reuse of bases. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I guess it's a widespread situation.
That's what we call sites or
Superfund sites.
I know about Superfund sites, but are they military bases?
Yeah.
Well, some not all.
Most of them weren't put undone. Only the top 10% were in the smaller ones. There weren't any funds available for it. Most of them went to contractors. Did a very poor job in actually remediating it. And left a lot of the sites only partially clean. And then the disposal, where you put it, you just move it from one spot to another. So it's like a shell game to begin with.
Yeah.
The only real solution is not to
the
reuse
companies who make the weapons also get contracts to clean up the bases.
Yes. Yeah.
It's a win-win.
They recycle.
Yeah.
Good business. Anyway, well, thank you guys for hearing us.
There's one more.
Oh, yes.
Then we have 5 minutes.
Okay.
Oh, so I have a time limit here. Okay. A comment I want to say, I really appreciate your bringing up the issue of policy is certainly at least as important as trying to clean up the mess that was already made. Boy, that's a big one to cover because we don't have a democracy in this country. And the people who believe it are also not doing anything. But now I wanted to ask you, getting back to the nuclear radiation issue, you said that only uranium is being measured, but uranium comes in several different forms.
Yeah.
And not only that, but all of the DU doesn't just produce uranium, it produces all kinds of other radioactive elements. Are you
mean,
just including all of those
yeah.
When you say what you couldn't find any difference in?
Well, we measured uranium as a whole thing in all of these samples.
But what about some of the decay products?
Yeah. We didn't. In order to be able to measure isotopes of uranium, so that after that you could see if it's depleted or not, because it's a ratio of uranium 235 and 238. Mm-hmm. So the ones that the uranium that is depleted, it has more 238, I think. Is that correct? And less of the other. But the ratio changes. So the footprint of depleted uranium is very clear. You know the ratio of 238 to 235. But in order to be able to do that, you need enough uranium in your sample in order to be able to push it down to the next level, which is to do ratio analysis. In our samples, we haven't had enough uranium to be able to do the ratio analysis. Which means there isn't high exposure to uranium. Actually, people in Iran are exposed to a lot more uranium than Iraqis. We've had data on that. Iran has just a background, higher level of background uranium. And so as Iranians, we have higher uranium in our bodies than Iraqis. So,
but what about counting the radiation?
Right, that's what I mean. I mean, if there isn't enough overall uranium, then you cannot... you cannot go on to the next step and measure the ratios.
You can't count.
Because there isn't enough of it. Yeah. Or at least what I was told in the analysis of our samples, we were not able to go to the step where you measure ratios of isotopes. Because there just wasn't enough basic uranium to measure it. Now, if we find samples with high uranium levels, then we might be able to do the next step. But we haven't. Now, uranium particularly collects in long bones and in the marrow of the long bones. So if we really are looking for uranium, that's where we should be looking, to see if you see depleted uranium or other kinds of uranium. But we haven't had that happen.
I shouldn't be hammering on that.
No. I mean, that's an interest of a lot of people. So I think that people are expecting to hear about it. And I think at this stage, I think we should try to find some sort of it. But it's hard to find the samples because, like Dr. Al-Sabak said, people don't agree to offer, bones of their children who are dead. And in order to do that, you need it. You need the long bones of dead babies to analyze it, and we can't get it.
But the source of leukemia, I mean, that's...
That's right. Just the fact that leukemia is so high, it should be in the marrow of the bone. And we should be able to see it if we get the samples. Yeah, it's probably there, but we just don't have the samples to show for it. Yeah. Yes, sir?
Another topic, I don't know if you saw it in the New York Times today about the chemical...
I did, yes.
Which was West.
I did.
To that.
Mm-hmm. that was quite an interview.
Oh, I have a question about next steps and thinking about ways to try and reduce the rate, the elevated rate you guys are seeing. And clearly, it sounds like the first step would be to clean up the sites. But I'm wondering, you've mentioned that some of the Burt's effects, things, you know, those that are associated with folate deficiency.
Yes.
And then also some of the chemicals you've showed, like I know for arsenic, folate helps methylate it and clear it faster.
Right.
So I'm wondering if there's been any talk of additional supplementation of folic acid or something to at least reduce the occurrence risk overall.
That's a perfect preventive measure. Although I have to say that in Europe, bread, like wheat flour, is fortified with folate. So mothers get a lot of, you know, fortified bread. And, you know, it seems to me that it's not just that. I mean, you could do that and you would probably save some of the pregnancies with that. But I think it's much bigger than that. And what I'm thinking is, and we were going to write a proposal about this, it's quite possible that exposure to these high levels of these metals, it depletes folate reserves in the body. And folate is already itself very unstable and it goes really quick. So if you have this extra pressure, you are wiped out and you really have nothing. It will jack up the number of birth defects. So it would be a perfect way to try to save some of the pregnancies. But it's not something that can be done by itself. Cleanup is the immediate one. Thousands and thousands of broken vehicles are just languishing all over Iraq. It's just horrible. It's just horrible. You cannot imagine it. Miles and miles of it. You would not believe it. But it's true. It's all over, all around these cities, all of this stuff. Really large, piles of, you know, waste on top of it. And some of the stuff, you can't even tell what it is. It's a horrifying structure of metals and things, and you don't know what it is. But so.
And the problem is not with folic acid, because folic acid simply can be given to a pregnant patient, and she can compensate. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's not folic acid, it's with folinic acid, which is the precursor of folic acid.
Right.
It has to be converted by tetrahydrofolate from folinic acid to folic acid.
Right.
Folinic acid is very expensive. We use it for those patients who gave them cytotoxic therapy. So we have certain patients with gestational plastic disease. I don't know if you have ever heard about this. I got before, more gestational. We give them folinic acid, which is the precursor. These methods affect the folinic, the precursor of it. Mm-hmm. Even if you give this pregnant woman folic acid, which is present everywhere,
it might not metabolize correctly. Yeah. So you need the precursor. Yeah. But you cannot do that. I mean, it's possible to spend the money and have that, but ultimately I think it's a major cleanup issue. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you so much.